From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and it's a national day of mourning in Turkey after last night's terrorist attack on the airport in Istanbul. More than 40 were killed, more than 200 wounded. It's just the latest in a wave of attacks that have hit Turkey in the last year. The airport was operating today, and we spoke earlier with reporter Dalia Mortada in Istanbul.
Actually, a friend just called me from the airport a couple of hours ago. She had just boarded her flight, and I asked her, you know, what was it like? And she said it was eerily normal, that there was no difference compared to several hours before when the attacks had happened.
NPR counterterrorism correspondent Dina Temple-Raston has been following the latest on the story and joins us. And Dina, it's early, but what do we know at this point about the investigation into the attack in Turkey? We still haven't had a claim of responsibility yet, right?
Well, no, we have not yet. I mean, Turkish officials are trying to unwind this now. They say they think there are at least three foreign nationals who were involved. And among other things, the investigators are beginning to search for the taxi driver who dropped these people off. They say they got to the airport by taxi. And you may recall that the attackers in the Brussels airport attacks arrived in a cab as well. And in that case, the taxi driver was incredibly helpful to the investigation because he took police right to the apartment where he'd picked up the bombers. And Belgian investigators were quickly able to identify the bombers and their accomplices based on that crime scene. So Turkish officials are hoping for the same kind of break this time.
And the officials are going to be looking, I'm sure, at all of the security footage from the airport. What are they going to be looking for specifically there?
Well, they're combing through that, looking both at the footage that was inside and outside the airport to see if the attackers may have had any accomplices. I mean, the airport in Istanbul is the third busiest airport in Europe, and it has very good security. So that's why the gunmen didn't get very far. I mean, they started shooting almost as soon as they came in. There's some questions as to whether or not they actually started shooting outside and burst through the doors of basically what was an arrivals hall before you get through security, and then ignited vests very quickly. So in the Belgium case, they were actually wheeled in luggage that was carrying explosives, and they didn't have guns. This time, they appear to have had both. And there have been intelligence reports and chatter that ISIS had forward-deployed 24 operatives to Turkey late last month. And that's one of the reasons why security alerts went up around Europe, because they've been expecting a series of summer attacks on vacationers. And there was also a concern that ISIS was going to move these operatives to Turkey to allow them to move on to Europe and maybe attack Turkey as well. So the Turkish authorities were sort of bracing for something to happen.
But as we said, there hasn't been a claim of responsibility yet. And yet a lot of the authorities are saying this is classic ISIS. Why do they say that?
Well, for several reasons. The first is the target. Now, Turkey has been having a lot of trouble with the Kurdish separatist group, the PKK, which has been behind four attacks in Turkey so far this year. But the PKK doesn't focus on civilians like ISIS does. It tends to focus on military and police targets. So that's one clue that makes this think makes people think this might be ISIS. The way it was done is the other clue. This seems very reminiscent of the Brussels attack in May and the Paris attacks, which used both explosives and guns on November 13th, when they shot up, you will call, all the cafes and a concert hall and tried to get into the Stade de France. So the other thing that sort of makes officials, gives them a bit of pause and wonders whether or not this might be ISIS, is that today happens to be the second anniversary of ISIS's declaration of the caliphate or Muslim homeland. And officials that I've talked to say they don't think the timing of that is really coincidental.
Yeah, that's NPR's counterterrorism correspondent Dina Temple-Raston with the latest on the investigation into the attack in Turkey. Again, more than 40 killed, more than 200 wounded. And of course, Dina, a lot of people in this country wondering about the security, outside security at airports after not just this attack, but as you mentioned, the one in Brussels as well. Dina, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, today, the 27 countries that will remain in the EU are meeting in Brussels without Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron to determine a way forward without his country. In London today, Cameron briefed members of the British Parliament about his meeting yesterday with the European Council, the first since the UK voted to leave the EU.
We were clear that while Britain is leaving the European Union, we are not turning our backs on Europe, and they are not turning their backs on us.
Well, what does that mean? Leaders of the Leave movement are now under fire for backtracking on promises to take the money Britain pays to the EU and use it to fund the UK health system. They've also been scoffed at for wanting now to stall a leave from the EU. Syed Kamal is chair of the European Conservatives and Reformists Group in the European Parliament. He's a member of that parliament representing London. He joins us from Brussels. And Syed, you've been with us before. In March, you decided to back Brexit. Are you having buyer's remorse?
No, not at all. I think I've always said to young people that I helped to get into politics, I always say to them, look, make sure that whatever happens in politics, that you, as much as possible, you stay true to yourself. I weighed up the arguments on both sides. There were some very good arguments on both sides, but there were also some bad arguments on both sides. The issue that really struck a chord with me, and actually I found this for many people, was that they voted on the issue that resonated with them the most. And for me, I've always wanted to see a fair immigration policy where everyone outside the UK is treated equally, whether you're from Austria or Australia, Croatia or the Caribbean, India or Italy. And unfortunately, that was not possible with our current arrangements within the EU. What you see is if you are outside, come from outside the EU, you have this issue of passport discrimination compared to people inside the EU who can come in.
Well, you're saying that this resonated for you on the Leave side, but what about the accusation that a lot of what the Leave leaders campaigned on was false? Take immigration. They gave the impression that there would be zero immigration, and now your Conservative colleague in Parliament, Daniel Hannan, has said there was never going to be zero immigration. People who voted to leave felt they heard that there was. The money that we mentioned, leaders such as former Conservative Party leader Ian Duncan Smith are saying now that the £350 million that leaders like Boris Johnson said would stay in the country and pay for health care instead of going to the EU in a fee, will now much of it have to go to farmers to make up for the EU subsidies that those farmers are going to lose. What do you think about the accusations that the campaign, you know, some have called them outright lies in the campaign?
Actually, I think there was a lot of nonsense on both sides of the campaign. So I'll give you one example. There was one day in the campaign where it got very silly, where someone said from the Remain camp, if you vote to leave, Britain will be like North Korea. Nobody will talk to us, which is clearly nonsense. And then on the other side, there was someone who said, if we vote to stay, then what will happen is that 75 million Turks will turn up in Britain. That was also rubbish. But I think most British people saw through that when they cast their vote.
Well, what about the idea that there's been no plan? Sky News asked a Leave legislator, can we see your plan? And he flat out, the lawmaker, flat out said there is no plan. Are you surprised?
I am surprised. I'm surprised that both sides don't have a plan. You know, I know one of the things I made clear yesterday in the chamber, in a debate.
Why would Remain have a plan for Leave? I mean, wouldn't that be Leave's job?
Who should have a plan for Leave should be the machinery of British government. And what I was shocked about was, you know, not the political side of government, but the administrative side of government and the civil service of government should have been instructed to say, look, we have a referendum. What happens after this referendum? You know, most companies should have had a Brexit contingency plan, and some did. And actually, here now in the EU, we're about to enter negotiations. And when you go into negotiations, both sides should have a plan. And there is no agreement at the EU what they will be asking for from the UK.
Well, I want to go back to you say immigration was your most compelling reason for voting to leave. Now, the Leave campaign argued for an Australian-style point system. This would allow in only immigrants with skills that are in demand, no matter where they're from, as opposed to the EU system, which would have open borders just for EU workers. Tell us more.
What you have at the moment in the UK is that people from outside the EU have to go through this amazing, these hurdles. I meet constituents who tell me their aunt or uncle cannot get a visa to come to a wedding. I meet restaurateurs who tell me they cannot get a visa for a chef. I meet IT professionals who say they cannot get tech experts from Ukraine to come in. And then they say, look, we see all these people come from the EU who don't have the skills we need, but actually they can walk straight in. That is an unfair immigration policy. That is discriminatory. And we have to get away from discrimination.
It's interesting. I just want to say it's so interesting because, in effect, you seem to be looking for more immigration, you know, people allowed to travel freely from non-EU countries, which if our reading, if our, you know, the reporting is correct. Most people who voted to leave, or a large amount of people who voted to leave, are anti-immigration. Are you worried if they don't get what they expect, they're going to be pushed further to the right?
No, actually, we, you know, it's not about more immigration. It's about a controlled immigration system where everyone's treated equally. And actually, both campaigns were coalitions. Whatever happened, someone was going to end up a bit disappointed.
Said Kamal, chair of the European Conservatives and Reformist Group in the European Parliament. He's a member from London, but he also was for Brexit. And we've been talking to him about the fallout since the vote. Syed, you might be out of a job soon, you know, as somebody who's a representative from London to the EU.
Yes, but I've always said, you know, one, be true to yourself. And secondly, you should be putting, you know, your principles and your country above your own personal position. And that's what I did in this case.
Syed, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Some called him Cecil, some called him Cecil. He was beloved. And a year ago this week, the black-maned lion was lured out of the Hwange National Park Wildlife Reserve in Zimbabwe by game hunters hired by Minnesota dentist Walter Palmer, who hit him with a bow and arrow, then stalked the wounded creature for hours, finally finishing him off with a rifle. Palmer had legal authority to kill the magnificent lion, though two men in his party were charged with luring the lion out of his refuge. There was outrage and a call to make it illegal to kill lions, but there was also new curiosity about how Cecil lived and concern about what would happen to his mates, his offspring. Well, that story is told in a marvelous young person's book called Cecil's Pride, The True Story of a Lion King. It's written by Craig Hatkoff and his daughters Juliana and Isabella, authors of a series of nonfiction books on animals. Some of us have Owen and Mazay about the stranded baby hippo who strikes up a friendship with a 130-year-old tortoise. It's great. Craig is also co-founder of the Tribeca Film Festival. He joins us from New York. Welcome.
I'm delighted to be here, Robin.
And the book is illustrated with stunning photos taken by Brent Stablecamp, who was something of a keeper to Cecil. He tracked Cecil for 9 years. He's Zimbabwean and joins us from there. Brent, tell us more about why Cecil, I mean, all lions are magnificent creatures, but tell us more about this particular lion.
First and foremost, he was probably one of the oldest lions that we've had on our study. So it was a lion that we came to know very well. He was very comfortable with tourist vehicles and therefore researchers sitting in their vehicles. So you could spend a lot of time with him and really get to know a lion for what he is in an unrestricted way.
He almost seemed to know how magnificent he was. He would sort of pose.
Yeah, I mean, in the way that lions do, they're the biggest cat on the block. They ooze confidence, so to us, it looks like posing. To them, you know, take it or leave it, they'll do that. We weren't there.
Yeah. Well, and he commanded respect from other lions. And, Craig, that's the story that you tell in the book. We go through the history of how he, you know, he was a cub, how he grew up. And, you know, these lions, although very social creatures, they fight like, you know, crazy for their territory. You tell that story.
Yes, it's. I don't think you can say they fight like cats and dogs, but maybe cats and cats.
Right.
This was arguably the biggest animal story that we've come across, and it was global in nature. It was a collective trauma. There was grief, outpourings, outrage. But the real key to do a children's book is what story do you want to tell? And what we didn't want to do, and when I say we, it's with my two daughters, Juliana and Isabella. We didn't want to tell a story about his death. We really wanted to tell a story about his life. But that entails finding out the story of his life, and no one better on the planet to tell Cecil's story than Brent, who kept watch over Cecil for 9 years.
Well, Brenton, take us through that, because as a young cub with his siblings, Cecil had to fight for the territory that they eventually took over. And then there was the son of another lion that they took on. I mean, it really is Lion King. There's a son of another lion, Jericho, that he at one point fights. But then what happens?
There was one male lion in each territory, and they were arch rivals. But then, as it happens, two younger males came in, displaced Jericho, chased him out, and then went to the next territory and chased Cecil out. And the two lions were lost to us for a while. Their collars weren't working. And then all of a sudden, one day, I get a call to say, you will never believe it, Cecil and Jericho have met up. They look a little uneasy together, but nevertheless they're together. And their relationship developed from that point. They came to a truce. They realized that individually they didn't have much of a chance, so they settled their differences and formed an alliance.
Well, but before that, you have an extraordinary picture in the book, one of your photographs, that shows them when they're fighting. They, you know, it took them a bit to get there. They were fighting for control of territory. And this picture that you take, if anybody has cats and has seen the cats kind of like play and get up on their hind legs and swat at each other, but then it gets, maybe they're not playing as much, you know. It's kind of like that, only they're lions. I mean, they could, you're reminded that they could have killed each other in a heartbeat. They didn't.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a lion fight is really incredible to watch. They're about 250 kilograms each, 500 pounds. And, they're really going at it. But if you think about it, you know, a fight to the death, one of you is going to lose. So it's advantageous not to fight.
Yeah. Well, when you heard, you know, as Craig writes in the book, you're thinking, this is not going to end well. But then, lo and behold, there they are together, and you have pictures, glorious pictures of them together. So now I don't know if I should anthropomorphize and call them friends, but there they are. What happened when Cecil died? What did Jericho do?
Well, that's a very sad few days, because as scientists, we don't like to anthropomorphize. We're trying to not sort of relate animals to human emotions, but I saw it with my own eyes, and it was reported for quite a while afterwards, that Jericho was moving up and down that boundary and calling, and not calling confidently, calling in a low contact call, which is really characteristic of an animal that's unsure of itself now and desperately trying to communicate with its coalition partner or its pride mates. So definitely he realized that Cecil was missing and you know, it was a shell of his former self for a while, whilst he came to terms with that.
Yeah. Well, and then there was another big question, Brent, that you had in Zimbabwe. Traditionally, when a male lion, when the king of a pride is killed, removed, and there's another male that comes in, much as Jericho would, they get rid of the cubs of the king because they want their own bloodline. And Cecil had small cubs under a year. What was your fear and what happened?
Yeah, precisely. So our fear was that once Cecil was killed, Jericho would very quickly kill the cubs so that the females would come into estrus again and he could promote his own genetic legacy. But it never happened. He continued to sort of dominate that area, and recently photographs were published of all seven cubs, still very healthy. They're all females. They're almost out of the dangerous situation now because they're reaching sexual maturity themselves, which means they'll no longer be seen as a threat and, in fact, will start reproducing themselves. So it's been a wonderful story.
Well, no kidding. And Craig, as the storyteller, at this point, if I'm reading this to a child, I'm sobbing. You know, your thoughts, I mean, as someone who, you know, looks for these kinds of animal stories, your thoughts?
Well, I think to tell this kind of story, you have to first find an entry point to the story. And obviously, this story has sort of a beginning, a middle, and then an end, and actually with an epilogue. The clan relationship, the Hatfields and McCoys, the Capulets and the Montagues, immediately as soon as I heard about that, as Brent was laying out the history, which really wasn't out in the public conversation already, you know, we get, it's called the goosebump test, and where's this going? And then to find out about the relationship that evolved between Cecil and Jericho was extraordinary. That was sort of the oh my God moment. And we, you know, we like to think of stories that we meet the, have the awe principle, which is awe, wonder, and enchantment. And then as we move towards the end, to find out what actually happened after, we do not dwell on Cecil's death at all.
I want to ask you about that. You don't at all. I mean, why is that?
Well, everybody knows what happens. And what we really try and do is invoke a platform for having lots of different conversations. The real power of it begins after you've read the book and you have a frame of reference, and it allows kids to start attaching meaning and purpose to life. Purpose is every kid I've met wants to do something about our endangered species. And the meaning in life is filled with bad things happening, but we have to go on. And so when you can find a story like this, it really does inspire people that out of the darkest hours, hope always emerges. And that's what we think, that's how we close the book.
Well, and Brent, it is a, you know, a terrific story that Craig and his daughters tell well, gorgeously illustrated by your photographs.
Thank you.
But I just can't imagine you'd rather not have this story.
Yeah, look, as scientists, we're supposed to be cold and distance ourselves from being emotional about our study animals. But to me, that's always been a little bit of a tall ask. You know, I've spent literally thousands of hours in the company of lions, individual lions. So, no, it hurts. It hurts deep. But I think the shining light is Cecil's legacy. I mean, when I reflect on the changes that that individual lion has made for his own species, and I think for a global, geez, just to wax lyrical, I think a global awakening in terms of how we view the environment and our relationship with it. To me, that's the shining light. I try and dwell on that rather than, you know, the physical loss.
Brent Staplecamp in Zimbabwe, a photographer and lion researcher who followed Cecil the Lion for almost a decade, and Craig Hatkoff, the writer, along with his daughters, of Cecil's Pride, the new beautiful picture book with pictures by Brent. Brent, Craig, thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us.
And by the way, there's going to be a rally in Washington, D.C. to remember Cecil, and both Brent and Craig are going to be there. So for more on that and to see some of these beautiful pictures of this noble creature.
Today, about 65 Illinois newspapers printed editorials, a dozen on their front pages, calling for the Republican governor and Democratic lawmakers to solve a budget stalemate that, as of this week, has been going on for a year. Joining us via Skype from Springfield, Illinois, is Angie Muse, executive editor of the State Journal Register, one of the papers that ran an editorial. And Angie, how did this joint effort come together among so many newspapers?
Well, Illinois has, of course, been without a budget since July 1st, 2015. And during that time, the SJR editorial board, like many newspapers around the state, we've editorialized and editorialized. And I frankly think no one thought it would go on this long, but it has. And we felt that we needed to do something a little more dramatic to convey the seriousness that we're now approaching if we get to Friday with no budget for the second year. So it began as maybe we should do a front page editorial, which is something that the State Journal Register has not done in at least 30 years, possibly ever. Then we began reaching out to some of the other newspapers owned by Gatehouse Media in Illinois. And, you know, their editorial boards were very quick to jump onto the concept that we all publish on the same day. And that spurred us to work with the Illinois Press Association and reach out to all the newspapers in the state to see if they were also interested in doing some kind of editorial today as lawmakers return to Springfield.
And for people who are outside of Illinois or haven't been following this closely, just give us a couple of the key points of how seriously this has affected the state over the last year, having no budget.
Sure. Some things have been covered through court orders, including the state workers' salaries. But cities and towns, for instance, the city of Springfield is owed several million dollars in electric and water bills. The United Way of Central Illinois last week did a survey that found that approximately 1 million people have been directly affected by social service agencies having to cut back their services because they, too, are not getting the funding. The state's higher education system, colleges and universities have not been getting their funding. There have been hundreds of layoffs. You know, there's a couple that there's serious concerns about whether they'll even be able to keep operating in the fall. And then more than 130,000 need-based college aid applicants have been denied their grants. And initially, a lot of colleges were trying to front that money to those students, but they have now reached the point that without state funding of their own, they're having to cut off these need-based grants to college students.
And meanwhile, the state's credit rating has been downgraded, and that only makes the problem worse because it makes it more expensive for the state to go out and borrow money.
Exactly. And the state is also racking up millions of dollars in interest on the late bills that it's paying.
Do you think that something will finally happen as a result of your editorial editorial and the editorials of other papers around the state?
I don't know if it will be as a result of our editorials. The governor and the four top legislative leaders met for several hours yesterday. They said they were optimistic, but they have dueling bills. They're several hundred million dollars apart. The governor raised the prospect earlier in the week that if we don't have at least a stopgap bill, the state's correction system is saying it doesn't know what will happen with it. It's the implications, you know, they have raised the very real prospect that without a K-12 funding bill, schools may not open on time or may not be able to stay open. You know, it's really become a dire situation here.
That's Angie Muse, the executive editor of the State Journal Register newspaper in Springfield, Illinois. Angie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Bike safety is top of mind right now in San Francisco, where two bicyclists were killed in separate hit-and-run collisions a week ago. Police say a man driving a stolen Honda through Golden Gate Park crossed into the wrong lane to pass slower cars and hit 41-year-old Heather Miller. 2 hours later, 26-year-old Kate Slattery was struck by a driver who ran a red light in another part of the city. The incidents have renewed a traffic safety debate that's going on in many cities where biking is booming and accidents are happening. Joining us now is Chris Cassidy of the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition. And Chris, your group says the city's not doing enough to make the streets safe for cyclists.
The bottom line is collisions like these are predictable and preventable. In San Francisco, we know where severe collisions are most likely to happen. They happen on high injury corridors throughout the city, as identified by the Department of Public Health. In fact, 70% of severe injury collisions in San Francisco happen on just 12% of our streets. So we know exactly which streets need improvements.
And why aren't the improvements happening, do you think?
I think that there's a lack of leadership. We need transformative leadership in San Francisco to see our streets improved for everybody who walks, bikes, and drives. And at the end of the day, we don't have a transformative leader. We have Mayor Ed Lee, and he's failing the people of San Francisco when it comes to delivering safer streets.
One thing that has been said about what's happening in San Francisco is that it's a city that is booming, and just perhaps the infrastructure for bicyclists has not caught up with the boom in population. Well, what do you say to that?
In addition to population increases, we also know that bicycling, the popularity of it is rising faster than that of any other mode of transportation. Last year alone, there was a 9% increase in the number of bike trips taken in San Francisco. And over the past 10 years, we've seen a 184% increase in the number of bike trips taken in our city. So what's clear is that the people of San Francisco are shifting how they get around. They're embracing active transportation, and they're embracing healthier ways of getting around in terms of producing better air quality. But the city of San Francisco isn't doing enough to support them in those decisions. And at the end of the day, the transportation agency that's in charge of safer streets and the SFPD, who's in charge of data-driven enforcement to deliver safer streets, are failing the people of San Francisco. Both of those agencies answer to Mayor Ed Lee.
Well, what would you like to happen? Mayor Lee was just reelected in the last year.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. We would love to have a strong partner in the mayor's office, and we know that we have a small number of years at least to continue working with Mayor Lee. We would invite Mayor Lee to really take this opportunity to pivot towards safer streets. His administration has been one of offering lots of promises, including Vision Zero, the plan to eliminate traffic deaths in San Francisco by 2024. But at the end of the day, when we have an unprecedented night of two fatal collisions involving people biking in San Francisco, it's clear that unprecedented set of tragedies should be a wake-up call for the mayor's office as well as for our city agencies that are responsible for delivering safer streets.
So what would an ideal street look like in your view? How would it be designed so that it would be safe for bicyclists but also a good street for cars to drive on and pedestrians to walk along?
That's a great question. I think it's first and foremost important to look at how the street's currently being used. So if we're talking about a heavily bike street, let's actually take a concrete example in San Francisco. Market Street is the spine of San Francisco, going through downtown and out to the outer neighborhoods. And actually, it's the most biked street in the United States of America, with 67% of vehicles during morning commute hours being bicycles. That is thousands and thousands of bikes a day. And what we're talking about in Market Street is a very wide boulevard with plenty of room to make improvements. It's also the case that for most of Market Street, there's no on-street parking. So that's not an issue. What we'd like to see on Market Street, and what we actually have on parts of Market Street, is physically protected bike lanes with a physical barrier separating slower-moving, lighter traffic from heavy, fast-moving traffic. It's when you get traffic intermingling that causes dangerous situations. Another option for improvement is protected intersections. The small but extremely bike-friendly city of Davis, California, near San Francisco, has some protected intersections, and those include physical barriers between people biking through the intersection itself, while also having those barriers decreased so that people can go through the intersection without being impeded.
And how much would it all cost?
That is something that often comes up. But when you're talking about comparing cost versus human lives, it's really a calculation that we're not eager to go down that avenue.
Well, but it is part of the reality, though, right? I mean, you could say the same thing about an airplane, that why don't we just pay for everyone to have parachutes on the plane? But, you do have to have a cost-benefit analysis at some point.
Absolutely. And actually, this is something that came up recently with the city passing legislation to put black boxes in city vehicles. In that situation, I know the cost there was, I think, around $2 million. But they were looking at such incredible savings, not just in the value of human life, but also in lawsuits that the city is facing. So what we're looking at here is a similar situation where people in San Francisco are demanding safer streets. The people are supporting Mayor Ed Lee in delivering safer streets, but we're just not seeing a lot of action from the mayor's office. And frankly, it's hurtful and very disappointing.
That's Chris Cassidy, Communications Director with the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Jeremy, thank you so much. Take care of yourself.
In the high deserts of Arizona and the southwest United States, it's already hunting season, not for deer, elk, or antelope, but for what they leave behind. It's shed hunting. People are looking for antlers that deer and elk have shed during the winter. For some, it's a hobby. For others, a business. Stina Sieg from Here and Now contributor KJZZ in Phoenix reports.
When you go shed hunting, bring sturdy shoes, water, and all the stamina you can muster.
Let me know when you get tired, girl.
Especially if you go with these guys. Olin Beecher is hunting for horn with his buddy, Bennett Wakiyuta, on a rocky remote corner of the Hualapai Reservation in northern Arizona.
See that little white thing sticking up between the bushes? What's that, Bennett, right there? It's a stick? All right. Sometimes the sticks will get you.
Because it can be frustratingly hard to distinguish a sun-bleached stick from an aging white antler. These antlers can be as tall as 4 feet, but have this way of blending into the monochromatic high desert. So shed hunting takes a lot of peripheral vision and patience. But these guys, with their trekking poles and big backpacks, are just happy to be out here. For Wakiyuta,
it's a manly thing to do while making money and learning your land.
For Beecher, it's a chance to forget about his phone and watch.
Things you live by in society, leave them at home. Try to.
If they're lucky, by the end of the day, they'll have an antler or two, or a pile of them. Josh Epperson is sorting antlers outside his home in Camp Verde, a few hours south. Epperson is an antler middleman. He buys from shed hunters and sells to clients around the world.
It's an enormous business. I mean, it eats up millions of dollars.
Epperson says it's been what he calls a kind of gold rush in recent years because of two antler-fueled industries, medicines in Asia and dog chew toys in America.
They both want it equally as bad, so it's driven the price way up, probably the highest it's ever been.
We're talking anywhere from $3 to $14 a pound, depending on the quality. The fresher, the browner, the better. The older, the whiter, the chalkier, the cheaper. Epperson's been doing this 20 years, but not for the money, he says. He just loves antlers. He can even tell when two sides have come from the same animal.
I can't remember what I did yesterday, but I can remember an antler that I'd seen 10 years ago.
Back on the Hualapai Reservation, the hunt is going well. So well that Bennett Wakiyuta can say this.
I'm going to try to find no more.
And when he puts on his backpack, now with more than 50 pounds of antlers strapped to it, it sounds like this.
Oh, man. Shoot. Okay.
Wakiyuta looks grateful, if a little strained. For him, being out here isn't just about shed hunting. Wakiyuta admits that only a few years ago, he was drinking too much, selling drugs, spending entire winters in jail.
People hated me.
But little by little, being outdoors in the place where his ancestors lived helped change him. And shed hunting was part of it.
healing of yourself is what happened for me out here.
As his buddy Olin Beecher says, you've got to respect this place.
No matter what it gives you. A lot of what this place will give you is hurt feet.
And sometimes it gives you the antler mother load. Today's count, 12 sheds, worth about $300. For Here and Now, I'm Stina Sieg.
The roar that greeted Garrison Keillor this past weekend at the outdoor venue Tanglewood echoed off the Berkshire Mountains.
I hear that old piano from down the avenue.
This weekend, there will be a show at the Hollywood Bowl, one at the Minnesota State Fair in September. A new, different Prairie Home Companion hosted by Chris Thiele starts in the fall. But really, after 42 years, this is it.
Comedy live from the Music Shed here at Tanglewood in Lenox, Massachusetts.
No more stories from Garrison Keillor, the show's creator, and our modern-day Mark Twain.
Well, it's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon, Minnesota, my hometown, out there on the edge of the prairie.
Wayne, honey, you still there?
I'm here, yes.
Okay, right. Here now. Here's your dad. He wants to talk to you.
All
now,
right.
No more skits from Sue Scott and Tim Russell.
Yeah.
Yeah, Dad.
Or duets with singers like Heather Massey.
Oh, babe, I'm saying goodbye.
Or glorious noises from Fred Newman.
He's a very sensitive young man. A lot of noise going on around him. A lot of hunting.
Get him, buddy. Come on, get him.
Shooting shotguns. Some hunters hunting from helicopters.
We start our two-day goodbye to Prairie Home Companion with Fred Newman, a dyslexic kid from Georgia who fell in love with mouth sounds. He wrote a book about them. He eventually worked alongside legendary Prairie Home sound artist Tom Keith, who died in 2010. Now Fred's duets with Garrison are a highlight of the show.
Did I read that you used to get thrown out of class a lot, one time dragged by your lip?
Okay, I was lifted out of a classroom by my bottom lip, but I was not unique at all. Where I grew up is this red dirt, rolling hill area, middle Georgia, where the Br'er Rabbit stories were recorded in writing by Joel Chandler Harris, but these were former slaves. I heard all those stories told by the descendants of those guys in a little store, and they would, you know, wow, and he grabbed the cat and he slung him, and they, all that stuff would go, or like, an old man named Snipes taught me how to do a water drip.
You were just tapping your cheek.
Yeah. And it's tapping on my cheek, and I'm blowing the water out as if you had just brushed your teeth and it's spitting, go, and then I put them together. To see that come out of a 90-year-old man's face, who's dark, and it looks like a National Geographic relief map. Everything about him was like this. He talked like this, breathe. It was just, not unlike Garrison, you can hear his nose hairs. I'm that close to this guy, and there's a water drip happening right on a nail keg, and to hear this perfect water drip come out, that was a life-changing moment. And then I said, oh, this is great. I wrote a book about it. And then one of the first shows was this show called The Prairie Home Companion. Welcome, book author Fred Newman. And I went on and did Baby Elizabeth.
Hi, my name is Baby Elizabeth.
And I remember Garrison's eyebrows went up like two hamsters, you know, like looking at me. And I said, give me some of this.
Thought he'd find himself a little peace and quiet, and he moved up to New York City, but that didn't work out. Traffic and crowds. Then underground, there was the subway.
We almost never rehearsed that. Sometimes they'll just say, let's do something with office supplies. And the next thing I know, I'm my tie. Oh, get my tie! It's in the Xerox machine! You know, and I don't know what's coming. He realized I'm not a technician at all. I'm very much moment to moment.
So I was driving here on the Mass Pike. You know the Mass Pike? And I got rear-ended.
I really did.
And then a helicopter landed. Peter Lorre was in the helicopter.
Oh, you got rear-ended. Oh, it's more like Chong of Cheech and Chong than Peter Lorre.
Do people do that to you?
Yeah, I love it. I mean, it's what I used to do as a kid. I would turn on football games and we'd turn down the sound, and you know, it would. you know, sounds have always fascinated me.
Well, I'm just thinking what an opportunity Garrison Keillor gave y'all, because there's really not a lot of call for someone who can make horse sounds on his chest. Or
It is a dark art, and one that's usually relegated to the back of a classroom. Yeah, and I mean, there's no demand for live sound effects delivered fresh and improvised on a stage. There's no call for that. But Garrison does, from start to finish, that show is one big piece of jazz. It's always done live, totally in the moment, and it pivots on a dime. Someone blows a note, we got to blow an honest note back.
And be out there, Fred.
Okay.
What?
So,
to be continued.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Mouth Sounds artist Fred Newman, and we will continue our Goodbye to Prairie Home Companion in its current form backstage at Tanglewood tomorrow with host Garrison Keillor and the rest of the Royal Academy of Radio Actors. Well, there's just two, Sue Scott and Tim Russell.
That must have been your boyfriend, Larry.
No, Jim, that was you. Come on. We went to a movie, and then we parked looking over the lake, and the stars were shining on the water, and we were naked in the front seat. Oh, you know what? You're right. It was Larry, come to think of it.
What will we do without them? Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.